majority. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to it.
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
Majority Report.
Far more credible than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report. With Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 12th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heart of downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Break the Internet Day, folks. Fight against net neutrality. Have it head over to battleforthenet.com to send your comment, contact your representatives about the assault on net neutrality. That's what that static was about. I mean, for those of you who didn't figure that out. Also on the program today, Malcolm Harris on Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. For the 20 known women that Trump allegedly groped, speak out again yesterday. Meanwhile, 21 kids sue the Trump administration over our government's climate change response. It's Jones versus Moore today in Alabama. Get out and vote. There's so many reasons to vote against Roy Moore. We may not have a long enough show to count. And the heartwarming story of a small little right-wing slush fund disguised as a college. Meanwhile, a third court rules against Trump's transgender military ban, Pentagon to accept transgender people shortly. Once again, Republicans trying to get that tax deal done by Friday. They're having troubles. They want to get it on Trump's desk within 8 days. The failed New York City bomber, apparently inspired by ISIS. Trump now wants a second special counsel to investigate the first special counsel.
Double up.
And France begins a brain drain from this country. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we did our little sneaky break the internet thing up front. I think that worked out pretty well. In fact, we also did a fake start of the show today as part of that as well.
It's very well executed.
Totally well executed fake start of the show.
Totally planned.
Totally planned.
Totally unprompted, but also planned.
Planned and unprompted. So today is the big election in Alabama. And, you know, so what you heard yesterday, of course, was the what they call the closing arguments of a campaign. This is where you basically want to give people the final reason for why they should get out and go to the polls in support of your candidacy. And Roy Moore, who has been hiding out, apparently not really being seen much in public in Alabama, wanted to show that he was quite a family man. So he brought out his wife. Her name is Kayla. Is that it?
Yep.
Kayla Moore. And here she is making one of the key points of the Moore campaign's closing arguments. I give you Kayla Moore.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews.
I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew. We have very close friends that are Jewish and rabbis, and we also fellowship with them.
Bam! In your face, one of our, and I didn't even have to mention the accountant Jew that we use as well.
You know, a lot of people question my links to Minister Farrakhan. Guess what? Got a Jewish lawyer.
And
don't
also,
boo. One vote.
One of our housekeepers is also a Mexican.
There
so
you
there.
Go. They employ a whole range of people and services to them. I really do think that you've lost that argument when you feel it's necessary to make the argument that we hire a Jew as our lawyer.
Yeah, I did date some girls as a community organizer. Always ask their moms first. Don't boo. Vote.
There you go.
She learned the closing a lot as a 14-year-old about Cabrini Green from me. Her mom was into it. See you Tuesday.
Jeez. Folks. The only thing that, over the past couple of weeks, we had this little controversy there where it looked like for a while that I had lost my job going on television. And there was one or two things that struck me. One, like, oh, my folks are going to be bummed because they like to see me on TV. And they like it when, like, their neighbors come over and say, hey, we saw Sam on TV. And then it makes them feel good about me. The other thing I was like, I honestly did have this thought, like, I'm not going to shave. And then how am I going to, I'm not going to be using my Harry's razors anymore because I'm not going to shave. There's no reason for me to shave. If I'm not going on television, why should I shave? Sometimes it gets a little itchy.
How does your wife feel?
She doesn't, she's okay with it. She doesn't really make a comment about it.
Sam can be sort of, it's like almost like alpha cuck. Is how it describes Sam.
That's right.
It's very interesting.
That's right.
Kind of contradiction and paradox
right,
there.
Right, exactly.
The animated series. Yeah.
That's right.
Power cuck.
Power cuck, exactly. But I did. It did occur to me, like, what am I going to do about Harry's? Because, you know, I've been using their product, I don't know for how long now, couple years.
Couple years, right? They've been with us for a while.
And, but then I got the job back. I went on Hayes last night. I had to shave. All's well that ends well. And folks, this holiday, Harry's is offering custom and limited edition shaving sets that make the perfect gifts. They're built with your guy in mind. The sets come with German engineered 5-blade cartridges that provide a close, comfortable shave. That's the Harry standard. Foaming shave gel that smells amazing. Also the Harry standard. But they got special limited edition winter chrome and emerald green handles. And you can personalize it with engraving. It's all packaged in beautifully designed gift boxes starting at just $10. Great for stocking stuffers or even for yourself. No matter what you're looking for, Harry's have you covered. And as a special offer, we have partnered with Harry's to give you $5 off your order when you go to harrys.com/majorityreport. The offer is only available for the holidays, and we don't have much more time with that. So this holiday, give Harry's and give handsome. Shipping cutoffs ends this week, so act now. Get your gifts delivered in time to get a limited edition holiday shave set while supplies last. Go to harrys.com/majorityreport right now. That's Harry's, harrys.com/majorityreport. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I spoke with Malcolm Harris on his new book, Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Quick break, and we'll go to that interview. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Malcolm Harris. He is a Philadelphia-based writer and author of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Welcome to the program, Malcolm.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
The urge for someone my age to say, what is wrong with you people? It's just as a way of opening this interview is, it's pretty great, but I'm going to resist it because I feel like I have a very good sense of what's going on with that. And so let's start with what the concept of human capital is.
Yeah. It's something we hear about a lot in various contexts, in terms of urban planning or education. But I think it's really important thinking about our whole economy and society right now. Basically, human capital is the skills and abilities that we acquire, that we put to work when we're doing work. So it's knowledge, it's how to use tools, whenever we're using our iPhone, whatever. And human capital has to be acquired. You have to learn these skills, acquire these abilities, and we measure that. And that's what employers are looking for when they're going out to hire people.
And, I mean, your argument is basically that the millennial generation is one where, I mean, it's almost... That is that human capital is almost it's being taught to them or was taught to them at an early age that is the primary reason for being on some level is to accumulate that capital.
Yeah, one of the stories in my book is a letter sent home to parents of kindergartners explaining that they weren't going to do the school play this year because they didn't have time, because they had to do so much curriculum, because the students had to be trained for the 21st century workforce. And so, there's a real thing that happened and probably happens more and we don't hear about it. But when we talk about stuff like that, when we talk about school as training for the workplace, for this job skills, that's human capital. We're talking about human capital.
All right. Well, let's define what is the millennial generation, and then I want to, tell us what defines the millennial generation, so we know who we're talking about, and then define for us what your sense is of what a generation, in and of itself, is.
Sure. So in the book, I'm mostly referring to people born, Americans in particular, born between 1980 and the year 2000. And that's a rough range, because what a generation is are a temporal cohort who share certain sets of commonalities that are defined by certain sets of commonalities, common experiences. And in the book, I write that they're defined by crises in particular. So the crisis, I think, that defines the millennial generation more than anything else is the divergence between compensation and labor productivity. It's called the rate of exploitation. And the growth in the rate of exploitation is an experience, is a trend that defines that the existence of this cohort, that the characteristics of this cohort emerge out of that process more than anything else.
So this gap between essentially wages and productivity is, I mean, how is it? Okay, so this is at a crisis point. And what is it about the timing of that Is it directly impacting those people in that cohort, or is it sort of like a bank shot? Their parents are aware of it. I mean, how does that crisis interact with people who were born in 1999 and maybe just like now graduating? Maybe they've just they're still in college, I guess. Versus somebody who was born in 1980 when they would be in their late 30s. Theoretically, right, on their career path.
And there are still millennials in high school, even. But that experience, that living in a world where we see this trend start, wages and productivity, compensation and productivity start diverging around the late 70s, early 80s. So that's when this generation starts being born. And that's when society becomes aware that this is how things work now. Sometimes we call it neoliberalism, But if you're a millennial, that's just like the world. That's how the world works. It's capitalism. It's unfettered capitalism. It's a winner-take-all market. And it's human capital over everything. And that affects, that has affected childhood, how we raise people, the incentives for parenting, all of these things. So someone who's alive now might have a different experience of that process, or someone who, we're all alive now, hopefully. Many of us are alive now. Someone who's in high school now, someone who's still hasn't graduated, might have a different experience, will have a different experience of that process than I did, or someone 10 years older than me, even. But our lives have all been shaped in large part by that divergence, by the rate of exploitation.
So it's a continuum, or at the very least, you all share that sort of fundamental understanding of the world or experience of the world. It's manifesting itself in a slightly different way. I mean, I find this this topic to be fascinating, and I think this is it has occurred to me. I mean, I think it's come out in the context of how data obsessed things had become in the over the past 20 some odd years. And, my theory has been it's because there's no room for margin of error. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, because you basically track this through through both sort of, I guess, temporally through school into college for some people and then into work. You also look at this phenomena in the worlds of entertainment and culture. But let's focus a little bit on school, and by school I mean elementary. You mentioned that you talk about a story about kindergartens who didn't have time to take off from their curriculum to do a play because they got to get ready for a 21st century workforce. It's funny. It's also terribly distressing. You talk about the phenomena of helicopter parenting as risk management. Explain that.
With income inequality increasing, we have the stakes of childhood increasing as well. It matters more now, or in the last 20 years, than it did 50 years ago, whether or not your child falls on the positive or negative side of income division. The division was not as stark. You could make a life for yourself. You could make a solid, happy life, for your stable life for yourself on a middle-class income. And so parents didn't face the same stresses, same stakes, same heightened stakes in terms of raising kids who will be successful as they do now. And so, yeah, we see this phenomenon of helicopter parenting, and we maybe talk a little bit too much about parents of means, particularly mothers of means, who involve themselves too much in their child's lives, who put their finger on the scale, make the system even more unfair than it already is. In my research, I ran into a lot of accounts of middle-class and working-class parents, again, particularly moms, who have taken on this extra whole job of advocating for their child, trying to help educate their child, trying to keep their child on the right track, because they know what the stakes are. They know that this really does matter, and the consequences for not being one of the successful few could be really, really high.
And this is also happening in not only with sort of unprecedented income inequality, but also a greatly inhibited mobility for this generation in terms of income as well. And so, I mean, so you've got these parents who are aware of the stakes that, I mean, how do you square that circle that parents of, like, I guess, presumably my age, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, when we talk about the parents of millennials, we're talking about people who would be anywhere from, I guess, their late early 40s to into their 50s, late 30s into their 50s. I mean,
even a little older, I'd say, but.
Okay, so essentially in my cohort, Generation X, maybe almost quite, you know, almost boomer, but not quite. How does our generation have that sense? I mean, what are the indicators that we're getting that's the case for our children that age?
What are the indicators that they're getting that the stakes are higher?
Well, I mean, we have this paradox, right? Because there's a lot of people in my generation who I hear bitch about millennials, frankly. You know, I mean, I think to a certain extent that comes from boomers, but it comes a lot from my generation. And yet they were also at one point acutely aware of the challenges that their kids were going to face, which is why they were pushing them so hard. Or were they simply just looking at their... Or was there more of like a groupthink looking around saying like, holy cow, we got to get on the ball. Johnny's got to be doing multiple extracurriculars. It doesn't matter that he's in second grade. You know, we're going to need this to build up curriculars that will follow this.
Yeah, we definitely hold contradictory ideas about this cohort. We think one of the famous ones is that millennials are psychologically weak. And at the same time, they're driven much, much harder. The demands, the psychological demands put on this generation are harder in many ways. And parents are also able to keep contradictory ideas in terms of their child versus other children or all children in their children's cohort.
Right.
So Billy works very hard, but in general, all his classmates are a bunch of losers and blah, blah, blah. People like to see their children as exceptional, which becomes a huge problem when we talk about policy and parents being involved in policymaking.
You refer to college admissions as a rating agency for kids. I mean, take us through education for that millennial generation and other sort of benchmarks that, because we're not talking about developing a holistic, right? It's not really a holistic education. It is really it's data points that I think you referred to them as investment vehicles, students of that generation.
In my lifetime, I think we've seen education and education policy and education metrics shift more and more towards the idea of job preparation and job training. So we saw that under Bush with No Child Left Behind, and we saw it under Obama as well with Race to the Top. And the Obama administration in particular, their rhetoric on education was very heavy in terms of college preparation and job preparation. And the whole idea behind the Democrats' education policy and the plan was to produce human capital at state expense for private industry, on behalf of private industry, so that companies could then go out and hire the workers they need at the price they want, paid for, trained by the government in our schools. And that sort of happened unquestioned because it went under this rhetoric of public education, and education in general, no one wants to oppose education. And so under that guise, they retooled what it is we were supposed to be educating children for in the first place.
I mean, it's fascinating when you put it that way, because it's certainly one begins to understand the motivations, even if they're not sort of fully frontal in their own consciousness of so-called school reformers in the school reform movement, is because they are judging the quality of education simply as a function about how hireable it will make these outputs, essentially.
Absolutely. And I think liberal defenders of public education have done themselves a real disservice and have put themselves in a very tough situation by making education and education metrics about employability, because then private industry is going to come in, private you know, charter schools, whatever, going to come in and say, we can do that better. We can be more attuned to the interests of corporations. You know, if they want kids to code, we will hear that faster, and we can implement changes quicker. And so there's a chance that public education, by setting the goals as human capital development, have really lowered themselves into a trap.
Talk to us about how higher education, I mean, you cite the figures, and I don't have them in front of me, about how much college education has risen in price over the past 30-some-odd years. And you very helpfully tie that into the sort of, the inverse defunding of public education, of higher education at that time, which I think adds to that price inflation, right? I mean, if your lowest cost option is more expensive, everybody else has the ability to raise their prices based upon that. But talk about the student loan industry that is really essentially a government run industry that is both, like you say, externalizing the cost of providing workers for industry, but also making a decent profit in the while doing so.
Yeah, so in elementary education, primary education, secondary education, we have now the state paying for students to develop their human capital on behalf of private industry. You know, in the higher education, that cost has been offloaded onto students and their parents primarily. Now, as part of Obamacare, actually, not a lot of people know this, but as part of Obamacare, there was a cost offset included that basically nationalized the whole student loan industry. And so we can understand why the Democrats didn't want to talk about that a lot, because they don't want the government to be thought of as the place that holds your student loan debt, but they probably are. And so the problem, as they quickly discovered, which is kind of a good problem to have for lenders, is that this program is incredibly profitable. And so they're predicting, you know, many, many billions of dollars of profit on each cohort of student borrowers. And they basically can't get that profit to go away just because the government's borrowing costs are so low, and people can't default on their loans. People have to pay them back because it's to the government. And this has created a situation where costs are still going up. They still haven't depressed costs at all because we know the government's going to lend the money, and we know the borrowers are going to be forced to pay it back. And so you don't have the same bubble threat that you have with the housing market, because in that situation, you have people walking away from their houses. You can't walk away from your human capital debt. You can't walk away from education debt. And so the threat here really is that the system just keeps on going, that people just owe more and more money and spend a lot of their life in indenture.
So talk to us about how this continues on for a millennial in the context of work in a way that is different. Is it different from other generations only insofar as they will know no other, experience of work? Or is it different in its severity? I mean, what is the millennial experience in work?
We've seen a few differences. One I talk about a lot is polarization. So you see jobs either becoming, you know, really good jobs, really well high-paid jobs, prestigious jobs, or really low-paid jobs, that you see the middle start to disappear in what we think of as manufacturing jobs, union jobs. All of these are union jobs. Government jobs. The government workforce has shifted a lot towards security. So that has all colored the millennial experience, as well as the growth of part-time work, all these apps and platform-based labor that is really just, you know, blockade running regulations. That's all that something like Uber is, in my personal opinion. At the same time, we've seen rents go way up, and which also changes how you engage with the labor market if you have to pay a higher rent. There it really has been different, that we face a worse labor market. And the idea that people are going to acquire enough human capital, that they were going to get enough job skills to make themselves essential, to make their time on the labor market comfy, hasn't really worked, because so many people went out and did that and acquired so much human capital that the market's flooded with it. You've got the situation where, you know, private industry says, we really want people who learn how to code. Everyone goes out and learns how to code. And then suddenly, hiring a coder is really cheap. They get what they asked for, and the people who went out and took the training burden on themselves get screwed.
And so, what about in the context of our entertainment? I mean, where does this manifest itself, this new, perspective? I mean, And what level of consciousness? Well, let's talk about it in the context of entertainment before we get to that other question.
Yeah. So one example I love using is sports, because it's so visible. So we've seen over my lifetime, like basketball players get much taller, football players get much bigger, and that's not, you know, human evolution or anything. That's market incentives in action. That means NBA has been cultivating people who are taller from a younger age. Recruitment has increased. Teams and industries and leagues and agents are going younger and younger in terms of how much human capital they're building in these children, so that by the time they're professionals, they're way more skilled and come from a more competitive process than people who played their position would have 30 years before. And so we see the same labor market trends, whether you're just a person trying to get a job, or if you're a professional football player or professional singer or whatever.
I mean, but how does this impact from, like, so that's within the context of working in that industry, right? Like, we hear the idea of, you know, specialize as early as you can, on these things, but how does it impact, I guess, sort of like the idea of non-work time? I mean, for millennials, like, where does it, how does it manifest itself in the life spent outside of the market? Or is that, or does that even make sense to say in the context of millennials?
It's definitely shrunk life outside the market. Social media, the tools we use to communicate themselves and express ourselves, to talk to our friends, are themselves for-profit platforms now. So if I spend my free time, my socializing time with my friends on the internet, talking to them through whatever ad-based platform or whatever, I'm giving that data over to whatever company. I'm still generating content for the market, for some market player, some very successful market players, in fact. Some of the most successful companies are the ones who have found the space between work and life and done their best to dissolve it.
It's interesting, because I'm thinking of my daughter, who I guess is would be a Generation Z. She's 12, she communicates to her friends via Instagram, and of course, she is both she's the product in that moment. She's also creating product for the platform, and then also is being trained to be her self-worth is a function of how many likes or you know, connections she accumulates on that platform. So it's a constant. It's basically like asking a fish, like, what's it feel to be wet, I guess.
Absolutely. And that's for a reason. That's useful. So when I was applying for jobs, you know, in college and after college, one of the first things they would ask me was about my social media proficiency. And I didn't have to have done it professionally. That was just, you know, can you do this? Can you do this for us? So those kind of skills are one of the things that millennials end up being valued for. So yeah, that's still market connected. Absolutely. She's still working.
So what, and what is the level of consciousness amongst, do you think, of your cohorts, the people in your cohort? What is the consciousness of this dynamic? Or is it the fish is like, I don't know, it's wet. I mean, what do you mean? We're in water. I mean, is that, how much awareness of this do you think your fellow millennials have?
I think it's changing. I think people are gaining perspective and more useful frames to understand what's going on, which is very hard because we've existed under this sort of neoliberal end of history framework for our whole lives in terms of our engagement with politics. And now we need something different because we're trying to understand what's going on and it doesn't fit in with that idea. At the same time, millennials don't own a lot of TV stations, radio stations, whatever, don't hold a lot of columnist jobs. A lot of the content about millennials is made by other people who might not have the same interests or might have other, you know, psychological needs to make up caricatures about this cohort. So we still have that kind of propaganda poisoning our minds.
You know, it's interesting because that dynamic which you just described, I mean, it's always been the case, right? I mean, that there are generations that are older than you that attempt to define who you are. I mean, one thing that I really am curious your thoughts on is that for people in my generation who were younger than baby boomers, I think to a large extent, there was very little room for our generation in all facets of society, simply because there were so many people in the baby boom, and that for a long time, their tastes, whether they were commercial tastes or artistic tastes or whatever, their life experiences dominated in the same way that, you know, a sapling is just not going to grow behind a big tree because it's just not going to get the enough. It can't compete for the water. It's not going to get enough sunlight, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder if there is that the distance between that baby boom cohort, right, which is aging out now. And I do want to talk about maybe the implications of that. But that cohort and they're not really being this sort of like missing, you know, Generation X on some level, that if you don't see the opportunity for millennials to begin to really have a lot of sway over where we go next.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at the particular relations between particular cohorts and not get into archetypical thinking with regard to generations, because when you start to dig into that kind of thinking, it usually turns out it's not that old, and in fact that it was a story made up by the baby boomers. So our idea of how generations relate to each other, period, is a story made up by the baby boomers. And you're right that they have controlled a surprising disproportionate amount of history of how things have gone, and that has continued into our time, and I'm not sure how much they are phasing out that cohort. If you look at Congress, for example, refuses to phase out. Certainly in terms of wealth, they have not phased out. And that is a particular cohort. It's not just, you know, old people in general, or your old people versus our old people, or whatever. The baby boomers in America was a particular cohort that experienced and has experienced more prosperity than perhaps any national cohort of all time. And obviously it hasn't been evenly distributed, far from it. But they're not, have not been invested that much in the reproduction of their success, let's say.
They took out a big, I think at least in a multitude of areas, you could say that they mortgaged a lot of younger people's futures in many respects. So what happens next? I mean, where does this go?
That's hard to say. If we look at the trends we have now, it's hard to imagine countervailing mechanisms or forces within the political system we have that could make up the difference that has gone on over the past 30 or 40 years. So if we look at that rate of exploitation for wages to catch up to where compensation is, or for compensation to catch up where productivity is, which is itself a process that would boost productivity. So compensation would have to go basically straight up. We'd have to see employers double people's pay out of the goodness of their own heart or of their sense of social progress. I don't think that's going to happen. That's very hard to believe.
I would be willing to take a bet that that's not going to happen. I would feel...
Well.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So assuming that doesn't, what, yeah, so, like I'm curious as to, I'm assuming it doesn't, right? And at one point, your generation is going to, and you're right. I mean, the baby boomers are just hanging in there, and like, it's a combination of like an enormous amount of people born at one time, the baby boom, intersects with, probably, I mean, I feel fairly safe in saying that, like the particularly in terms of people who have money, intersects with the greatest period of time of medical advances, right? That have mm-hmm. elongated their lives and their time in the workplace, and particularly for the wealthy, right? Because I mean, when we talk about Congress. Yeah, I mean, they're all in the upper half of the income distribution, and their lives have extended, you know, probably since from 100 years ago by 20 years, maybe more as an average, 25 years. And so they're hanging around longer. They're the first generation to hang around that long. But let's say 10 years out, I think you're going to see a pretty big change. What happens to this generation that has been basically said, we're going to put you in training from day one, as if you were like an Olympic future member of the USSR gymnastic team. We're going to put you in day one. You're going to be doing this, and then you get there and you find out, oh, the Olympics have been canceled. Yeah, sorry. I mean, what happens to that generation?
I think it could go one of two ways. So, and I like to think about it even a couple decades further along. So in 30 years, let's say, if we think about the world that millennials will be turning over to our children or even our grandchildren, just based on the ecological trends, never even in, if you throw in the exploitation trends, if those continue, the world we'll be handing over in 30, 40 years will be awful. It'll be a really, really terrible place. And we won't be able to blame our grandparents, our parents. No one is going to want to hear that. They won't care. It won't be an excuse. That'll be our bad. So millennials will have to take responsibility for this world. So that's one possibility. I think it's also possible that these trends create a crisis in which the basic fundamental relations of American society are torn asunder, and we rebuild from some very different, better premises. So if we have a better world to turn over, it's not going to be because we tinkered and fixed little things. It's because we really thought about and fought about the kind of world we wanted to live in.
It's a fascinating book, Malcolm Harris, Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, if you head over to majorityreportkickback.com, as we mentioned last week, completely unrelated to the other events that we had, our Amazon link went down. They shut it down. We have reopened it, but you got to go back to majorityreportkickback.com and click on the link there. It's not quite as obvious where the link is, but if you just look, just scroll down that page, I was in the middle of building that little Wix website when all this went down. So head over to majorityreportkickback.com, and of course we have our jet.com link there too for the holidays. And I should also say, tonight is the first night of Hanukkah. So for those of you who celebrate Hanukkah, like my kids, happy Hanukkah. Also, tonight is not the first night, but another night of TMBS, the Michael Brooks Show. It's only on one night. They only celebrate it one night a week as opposed to eight nights a week.
Eight nights a week.
Well, that's the Hanukkah thing.
Mm. Right.
Nevertheless, it is on tonight at 7 p.m. on our, you can watch it on our YouTube channel, or you can listen to it live on our app, actually, or you can just, of course, get it through iTunes after it becomes a podcast. And there's a whole Patreon mechanism that is involved in that, too, to support that program. What do you call that?
Patreon. Not a mechanism. Just say it's a Patreon, and you get a ton of extra content.
You're really
content.
Locking a lot of people out who are going like, Patreon, what is that? Is it some type of mechanism? They don't know. So it's a mechanism.
If you are someone who uses the word commissary often and bizarrely, let's say it's a Patreon mechanism.
Whenever I use the word commissary, it is always in context.
I'm genuinely like, when did you learn that word, and how did it take such a large role in your vocabulary?
I never worked at a big company. And the only thing I could think about was like, you could get free lunch there at the commissary. And so that was the one thing that I thought about. Like, if I ever wanted to, like, I could never come up with a reason why I'd want to work at a company except for like
briefly
the commissary. And the thing is, it's like, I don't know. Some people, there used to be cafeterias that you would go to that were like commercial cafeterias. Where you would go with your tray, and it wasn't like a school cafeteria, and you go around, and it was like you'd get the special of the day. I just remember that as, you know, when I was younger, and I always thought, like, someday I'm going to go to work at a company, and there's going to be a commissary there. And then
I have to be honest with you. I was racking my brain.
One of the few
this.
Things that I had contemplated as a child that I never got delivered as an adult.
No. Well, it's a shame.
So I lament it.
No, I think, honestly, the only other person that I ever met who used the word anywhere, and I'm talking like maybe like a third of the amount of time you use it, was there was a Turkish guy when I was studying at Middle East Technical University, and he didn't know, for some reason, cafeteria was commissary was the English word that he got, and he would be like, we'll go to the commissary for lunch, you join us? And I was like, sure.
There you go.
So it's you and that guy.
I usually associate it with prison.
I associate it with like Soviet re-education camps.
All right. Well, everybody's got their different notions of commissary.
Not like you're sort of like weird, like kind of like pre-Google fantasies of like corporate Dannyhood.
I got news for you. If you had mentioned the word Patreon to someone 4 years ago, they'd look at you like you were coming from a different planet.
I would have been like, is that some sort of mechanism?
Right, exactly. folks, also, just a reminder, justcoffee.coop.
But wait, hold on. Patreon.com/TMBS is where you can find the specific mechanism that we're talking about.
Justcoffee.coop. It's fair trade coffee, tea or chocolate. It is a co-op, so it's employee-owned. And if you respond to the sound of my voice within 3 days and use the code MRHOLIDAY, you will get 30% off of your coffee. Yeah. How's that for a mechanism? You just plug it in, the coupon code HR... Wait a second, what is it? What was it? MRHOLIDAY. Right. MR Holiday, get 30% off. You also get free shipping. Do not make the mistake of not taking this opportunity to try one of the many Just Coffees that I enjoy. Of course, there's a Majority Report blend. Also, we'll talk about this later, but we may have an opportunity for some of our listeners down the road to help us like get it into stores, like into coffee shops, based upon that coffee shop up in...
That would be very
Hudson,
cool.
New York.
It's good coffee.
It's great coffee. All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. We've got some more clips of Roy Moore and his supporters. Really, probably one of the most bizarre final messages of a campaign that you could ever imagine. But, of course, it's a pretty bizarre campaign to begin with, so you'd expect that the way they're trying to sell that. But listen, today, two things. Obviously, if you're in Alabama, I know that you're going to vote or you've already voted. You wouldn't be listening to this program. If for some reason you are listening to this program and you are saying to yourself, not going to vote, don't listen anymore. Don't. It just bums me out. You just basically
Doug Jones is a fucking corporatist, and maybe if we're in the Senate,
don't listen.
That'll accelerate like it could be the fucking revolution.
Just don't listen to the show anymore, honestly, because it's like
I didn't know you worked at MSNBC when you were talking about Doug Jones. Don't get me wrong, I don't like Roy Moore, but you gotta stop attacking Susan Sarandon. You're a little souffle of stupid right
there
now.
There you go. That was well served. And also, head over to, what is it, where should they go for the Fight the Net? It's at,
hold on 1 second. Sorry.
It's Fight for the Future, and their website is Battle for the Net, right? Isn't it battleforthenet.com?
Yes, it's battleforthenet.com, and there's a link on the majority.fm homepage.
And spread the word. Some people are suggesting, I don't use Facebook, but some people are suggesting change your Facebook status to married and list your partner as net neutrality.
See, that's exactly what they're doing. That's the globalist. They want you to be married to a pipeline definition, which is really a globalist scheme, globalist plot.
They're having sex with their cars.
They're having sex with their cars.
And they're now they're marrying marrying net neutrality.
Now they're marrying net neutrality. I suppose I'm homophobic. I don't think you can marry it.
I'm consophobic. You're marrying a concept.
Pipelineophobic.
So check that out. And see you in the fun half.